from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Charles Darwin is famous for theories including natural selection and survival of the fittest. He's less known for the inventive experiments he ran with the help of his family at home, which helped inform Darwin's groundbreaking book On the Origin of Species.
So many of the interesting arguments in that book were based on these curious experiments that Darwin was conducting, often literally in his backyard.
Author and biologist James Costa captures a different side to Darwin in his new book, Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. He'll join us in studio, coming up next, after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. More than 4 months after Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, nearly one-third of the island's residents lack power and thousands more remain displaced. Underlying these hurricane-related hardships are deep structural problems. Puerto Rico's poverty rate exceeds 40%, and the debt-ridden island is struggling to navigate its way out of bankruptcy. This hour, we'll discuss what needs to be done to improve conditions for the residents of Puerto Rico and steer the island toward economic recovery. First, we're going to go to San Juan and welcome our own John Sepulvedo, who is a host of California Report and who has been on the scene there. And John, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Michael. And I'm actually just left San Juan. I'm a bit to the west of it right now at a FEMA recovery center in Aguada, which is in the west coast.
Well, I want to get the on-the-site report from you because you were actually right in the where the eye of the hurricane passed in the west end, and described those as apocalyptic scenes.
Yeah, so even 4 months later, they were still seeing blue tarps, if people can manage to find blue tarps for their roofs. In many of the areas, we're seeing trees down. But most importantly, we're just seeing a complete collapse of certain buildings. And this is really important because the economy is as tenuous as it is before the storm even hit. And so if you take something away like the local ball field that had maybe perhaps some type of Puerto Rican baseball league, like the stadium I'm at right now, because there's no electricity during the winter season, that was a really important source of revenue for many people. If you take away the surf season, because many tourists aren't coming, if you take away the hotels, because that keeps many tourists from coming, then everyone down from the surf instructor to the person who works at the bar to the hotel is losing money. And this is a time when they desperately need capital. So there is the kind of apocalyptic landscape. Right now I'm still, like right across the street from me, I see metal roofs that are just completely bent out of shape. There's giant lights that for the stadium here that are bent sideways. It's almost like the light posts are drunk. They're leaning against a wall. And that is existing. But the biggest part of the financial apocalypse or the biggest part of the apocalypse here in those terms is the finances. This is just an absolutely devastating financial situation for many people to find themselves in.
Well, a third of the people, as we said earlier, without power, and about half the population of 3 million are in informal homes or illegal housing. And there's a disaster on that score. Healthcare, I mean, we could go through the whole list of things that really need help and need capital and need some economic sustenance. But I want to get to really the response, not only the immediate response to the disaster and the hurricane, but also the longer-term response. I mean, New York Times had a story about FEMA, and it was a shocking story. There was a woman who was hired, an entrepreneur, an Atlanta entrepreneur by the name of Brown, Tiffany Brown, and they gave her a contract of about $156 million, according to the New York Times. She was supposed to feed millions of people, and about 50,000 meals went there, and those meals, many of them weren't self-heating meals like they were supposed to be. I mean, this has just been a disaster.
Well, I mean, that's just one extreme, and that is a particularly egregious extreme because Tiffany Brown, I actually lived in Atlanta, Michael, for a while, and Tiffany Brown is a well-known person who of ill repute, if you will. She's somebody who just has gotten in trouble, kind of runs for mayor. I mean, just the fact that somebody at FEMA didn't do a quick Google search of the people who they're entrusting to feed, 3.5 million people. Although I would say the actual number of meals are much lower at this point because there's electricity in 70%. Where to start with the contracts? I've heard stories.
Wait, excuse me, John. She had 5 canceled government contracts. I just want to get this in, at least 5 that we knew of and you could have Googled and found. And she had really no experience in terms of large-scale disaster relief. None.
None. And that's not uncommon. We're hearing stories from locals about people from Mississippi, Alabama, basically the Southeast, Florida, who've moved in very quickly, bidding on contracts and are getting contracts that are just, it makes you scratch your head. The word that I hear, especially from the English speakers here, is supposedly. We hear the word supposedly. Supposedly FEMA's supposed to do this. Supposedly the government's supposed to do that. Supposedly we're supposed to get aid in this regard. Because on paper, it is said that, you know, all this money from this October bill passed by Congress, which approved loans, not grants, but loans to Puerto Rico, was supposed to help with this aid. And supposedly just never really pans out. I've heard just dreadful stories. There's tree branches everywhere. This is a very an island of a jungle, if you will. And there are tree branches everywhere. We expect that from the hurricane. But I'm hearing stories and seeing stories of contract workers cutting down perfectly good trees. Trees that don't need to be cut down because they're paid by the tonnage. And so it's easier for them to cut down a live tree that's near a port or near where they're at that moment than to go back and actually clear more of these mountain roads where people are still struck. I mean, it's just an amazing thing in the most negative sense of the word to hear the graft and corruption that's going on. And it should be noted, the alleged graft and corruption, a lot of this was happening before the storm ever happened. There were hurricanes that hit, I heard of one 7 years ago, where a community's been without power the entire time. I mean, that's just, when all of a sudden these things start to come to the surface, you start to realize how deep-seated some of the problems are. But I do think, Michael, it is so important for the audience to hear that despite the people here are doing well as they're doing because of themselves. No one is waiting for FEMA. I said I'm at a FEMA center. No one's seen FEMA here. This is all now at this point run by locals bringing in food, trading food, distributing water to people who still need it because the drinking water is still bad in parts of the territory. The people here are absolutely beautiful. I've seen them really work to help neighbors. They've all gone through, whether they are, you know, rich folks who live in some of the nicer places on the side of San Juan, or whether they're folks who are in the countryside, they all went through this just incredible psychic trauma, and they have really pitched together. I was just actually talking with 2 women who opened up this sounds very kind of hoity-toity, but they opened up a horse farm with all the abandoned horses that they found and some that they were brought before the storm. And they've started offering it as therapy to autistic children. And this is really important because the schools have been closed. So these schools, which are already failing, have had problems trying to just provide therapy for these autistic kids in the first place. And these women are doing it for free. And they're completely supported by the community. And I can think of another 4 or 5 stories right off the bat from my limited time here of things like that. People are really coming together to try and help each other. But that doesn't stop either people from the outside or people who are in the inside who are taking advantage of it. And it didn't stop, of course, the looting and theft that we saw immediately after. But overall, people are surviving and in some cases still thriving despite the lack of government response, not because of it.
And there are people outside who are helping immensely, too. Later on in this hour, we're going to hear from Orlando Bravo, a San Francisco-based investor and founder of a foundation who has raised $25 million for Puerto Rico relief. You've also commented on the fact that the hatred of the president is intense there.
Yeah, I haven't spoken to anyone who cares for President Trump, and even people. This is still a very it's a United States territory. These are United States citizens, but there is a great amount of anger towards President Trump, and that didn't necessarily exist before the hurricane. President Trump is seen as somebody he positions himself as a strong man, if you will, And Puerto Rico is a very macho culture. And so there are a lot of people who actually really liked President Trump. There are a lot of retired Army vets and things like that who are here, both from Puerto Rico and from the U.S. mainland, who really liked President Trump. But since I've gotten here, I haven't asked anyone about President Trump. I haven't actually asked about the response because people are just coughing it up, you know, really quickly. I do think that it's important to note, again, that the U.S. government gave a loan to Puerto Rico. They did not give the grants that we saw to the other hurricanes on the Gulf Coast, and that is significant because that means people have to pay it back. And even those loans there have been problems with distributing those. And the other thing, too, I think that's really important for people to remember, besides the fact that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, which we often have to remind people. I'm sorry, ma'am. I don't work here. You want to go down that way? Sorry, Michael. We had a woman come in asking me questions. These are U.S. citizens, and they give about $8,000 in federal taxes, and they get about $1,500 back. This is according to the Congressional Budget Office. So there is a lack of it's what in California we often hear people say, well, we're a donor state. Well, Puerto Rico is a donor territory largely. It gives more to the federal government than it gives back. And right now there's definitely a feeling not just about President Trump, but about the U.S. in general, that the U.S. looks at Puerto Rico as second-class citizens, that these are folks with citizenships, these are folks with Social Security numbers, these are people who pay their federal taxes on their Social Security taxes and things like that.
John, forgive me. I've got the mayor of San Juan on the line. I'm going to have to say goodbye to you.
Sure. But no, that's fine, Michael. I appreciate it.
No, and I appreciate very much your being with us. John Sepulveda, again, is host of the California Report. I appreciate the good work he's doing down there. And we have Carmen Yulín Cruz, who is the mayor of San Juan, on the line with us. And Mayor Yulín Cruz, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And I was actually having a very good time listening to the very accurate accounting of what Jeff was saying. Just want to clarify something. The loan, the $4.9 billion loan that was given to Puerto Rico has not been distributed. Not one cent of that has gotten to Puerto Rico. Now, some of it has had to do with some mishaps that the Puerto Rican government has had in terms of the Whitefish contract that your listeners may have heard, or a two-man Montana company was awarded a $300 million contract, which was later rescinded. There have been situations like yesterday in Kissimmee, Florida, a 50,000-pound food and water supply was discovered, which was rat infected, and the person that was in charge from the central government perspective mentioned that they didn't have the money to bring it down. Well, there's a fund called Unidos por Puerto Rico, United for Puerto Rico, which raised a lot of money and could have paid for that situation, for the distribution. So in the midst of this storm, and in the midst of this humanitarian crisis, things that were not right in Puerto Rico have been heightened. And most devastatingly is we have been able to look for those that didn't want to see them, the inequality, the discrimination, and the poverty in Puerto Rico, which certainly, that's why we like talking in San Juan about the transformation, not the rebuilding of Puerto Rico, because we need to transform our priorities, accept responsibility for the things that have not been done right, and change them and really wage a very fervent war on poverty and inequality in the island nation of Puerto Rico.
Now, how much do you need the federal government and infusion, really, of money here, particularly since there are many who say that Puerto Rico's problems preceded, especially fiscal problems, preceded what happened with the hurricane?
No, and certainly Puerto Rico's problems preceded the hurricanes Irma and Maria. But we have a situation right now where our entire electrical grid, which was weakened before by the hurricanes, was non-existent for months. We're getting close to the 150 days mark because I continuously have to say the world counts from Maria. But we have people that have not had any electricity since Irma. And that generation and distribution system has to be upgraded. It has to be transformed. We have to run away desperately from our addiction to fossil fuel and move to more renewable sources of energy. And that takes a lot of money. Now, it could take, it could be low interest rate loans. It could be foundation money. A lot of it is coming from the federal government. But one thing that people understand is because of the Jones Act, Puerto Ricans are forced to buy every good and service product that comes from outside of Puerto Rico in ships that have the U.S. Flag. And that increases the cost of living in Puerto Rico by 30 to 33%, so much so that President Trump, in one of the very few things that he has done right by Puerto Rico, lifted the Jones Act for 7 days during Irma and for 10 days during Maria. Now, that was nearly not enough. And that's why a lot of people, and everywhere I go and every forum that I have, I call for at least a partial ban. I think it should subsequently be eliminated completely. But initially, until we have a chance to sit down with our brother and sisters from the maritime unions and talk this over, at least a partial release from the Jones Act. USVI, which was also devastated and is also in dire need of a lot of help, has a partial waiver on the Jones Act for anything that has to do with energy. So that would help a lot. Last week, just to give you some numbers, still about 52% of our schools around Puerto Rico do not have any electricity, which means that our children are going to school part-time. About 30% of the schools still do not have water. About 750,000 people are coming to that 150-day mark without having any access to electricity. And in some cases, not having access to electricity means you don't have access to water, especially if you live in apartment buildings or in a mountainous region. So this is being an economy that was weakened before and that was even further weakened by the alleged tax reform passed by the Republican Congress, which imposed a 20% tax on Puerto Rican imports into the United States, tax that was not there before, and a 12.5% tax on intellectual property. So on the one hand, you have this money pouring into Puerto Rico, but on the other hand, you have what some called disaster capitalism or disaster economics. The current government has used this opportunity to privatize essential services. 2 weeks ago, the governor announced that he was privatizing the distribution and generation of the electricity, of course, using a very volatile time amongst people because close to a million Puerto Ricans still don't have any electricity and they will do almost anything to have it. And just 2 days ago, he announced the introduction of charter schools, which in many cases are the privatization of our educational system, our public school educational system. So we are having a lot of internal conflict.
Mayor Eulenkruz, I mean, the number of problems that you have are legion, and I think you've described them in a way that really has an impact on our listeners. You also have the biggest government bankruptcy in United States history of $120 mm-hmm. million dollars in bond and pension debt. We're going to talk some more with people who are on the scene and who have been on the scene. I want to get one final thought from you, though, if I could, and that is, when you were on CNN, you were, of course, expressing some concern about the fact that you were expressing some anger at the President of the United States, but also no clear set of goals coming from the feds. Is that still pretty much what you're upset about and angry about at this point?
Well, you know, when you're disrespected, when you are being asked to write memos and have people register via telephone or internet when there's no electricity, it's obvious that the job has not gotten done. Last week, FEMA announced that they were leaving Puerto Rico and were no longer in terms of the distribution of food and water. And they got a lot of pressure and they said, no, we're going to continue to stay. So, yes, the U.S. government has admitted bits and pieces that their approach to dealing with the humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico was not an appropriate one, to be very modest about it. But really, what happened is that lack of response in a timely manner, in a sensible manner, and in an appropriate manner has really, really made the humanitarian crisis even worse than what could have only transpired by the passing of these two storms through the island nation of Puerto Rico. So, no, the president and the Republican Congress have not done right by Puerto Rico.
Well, Mayor Yulin-Cruz, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate the time you've given. It's Carmen Yulin-Cruz. She's the mayor of San Juan. We've got Nick Brown on with us now. We're going to go to him. He's in New York. He's Puerto Rico correspondent, former San Juan bureau chief with Reuters. Nick Brown, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Michael, for having me.
Well, from your perspective, I mean, we got to look at triage here. What comes first? Electricity, food, water, housing? I mean, we've got this massive crisis going on.
I think it has to be electricity because everything kind of flows from that. Without power, there's very little that you can do to give people a good quality of life. But it's also not an overnight fix, as has been proven. And, you know, the challenge, there's really two challenges. Bringing back power in the short term is the first. And then the second is figuring out how to reinvent the grid so that this doesn't happen again. And that's something that is going to be a months or years long process. I think housing is also a really important piece because so many people are still not in adequate housing and haven't been for months now. And although a lot of those people have found other places to stay, many of them also haven't. And they are staying right now in their homes, which may or may not have roofs and other basic needs. So
many of them are living in illegal housing, or they're living in illegal subsidized properties, and they're living in places without permits and so forth. Yeah.
Well, that's right. I mean, hundreds of thousands. Estimates range as high as maybe 700,000, although it could be lower. Homes in Puerto Rico are informal, meaning either they were, you know, illegally subdivided, or they're just squatter communities. And you know, it's a great example of a way in which the federal government is struggling, I think, to customize these longstanding U.S. rescue missions with an island that in many ways is not anything like what we're used to in the U.S.
Nick, stay with us because we are going to bring our listeners into this. We're also, as I said earlier, going to hear from Orlando Bravo, who went down to Puerto Rico and actually has raised $25 million. And we want to hear from you if you have some thoughts about what you've been hearing here, or if you have some thoughts about Puerto Rico in the wake of the disaster and what needs to be done, what ought to be done, what should be done or can be done. We want to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments, join us now. 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Almost a third of Puerto Rico's residents remain without power. That's 4 months after Hurricane Maria, and we're talking about relief efforts there that have gone awry in many respects, and the ongoing humanitarian crisis and the needs that the people are suffering from. We spoke earlier with our own John Sepulveda, who is there, host of California Report, and with the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulin-Cruz, and Nick Brown is with us. He's Puerto Rico correspondent and former San Juan bureau chief with Reuters. And let me get a sense before we go to our callers here, Nick, of where culpability is here. I mean, there's going to be no debt payment, apparently, until 2022. And this is a fiscal crisis, an economic depression, the likes of which certainly Puerto Rico has never experienced, and that we haven't seen in any United States property or any United States citizens are located in a long, long time. We've also got some serious corruption problems, government corruption up to $1 billion, it's estimated. And I'm raising all this because looking at a statement here from a listener named Rick who says Mayor Cruz should not complain considering all the terrible financial mismanagement that has left Puerto Rico a basket case. Why toss money into a black hole with no one to properly handle it? You do hear that sentiment a lot, and I'd like to hear your response, Nick.
Right. Well, you know, the writer raises a good point, and I think Mayor Cruz also raised a good point. There has been a lot of corruption, and generations of Puerto Rican leaders have not been good stewards of their finances. But the results are not any less real from that. The suffering there and the need that's there is still pretty real. But you know, the loan from FEMA that we keep talking about is a good example of the gray area here, because what FEMA actually says is that Puerto Rico doesn't need that loan right now because it has enough liquidity to get by, and that it's negotiating with Puerto Rico on when that loan will be distributed. And it gets to the question of whether the numbers that are coming out from Puerto Rico's own government can really be trusted. You know, this is a government that has not published its certified audited financial statements, I think since 2014 or 15. So they're quite behind, and there's a lot of lack of trust both in the investor community and among leaders in Washington. But that narrative, you can only take it so far. I mean, regardless of where the culpability is, the need is real, and you can't let you can't let those things stop you from getting help to people. And that's what people are trying to figure out how to do right now.
Yeah, I'm looking at another listener comment. Sometimes throwing billions of dollars at a problem doesn't solve it. There's a good deal of sentiment coming along those lines. But in the meantime, the people are hurting and they're in terrible need. I just wonder, though, I was reading an article about over $500 million funneled during the debt crisis to Monsanto and other biotech multinational companies. They were labeled as farmers. The government considered them farmers rather than biotech companies. And I mention this not only because of the money, which involved preferential tax rates and tax exemptions and wage subsidies, but you had about 230 million gallons of water from the underground that were essentially given to these companies.
Yeah, I haven't been following the GMO thing and the Monsanto story, but you know, certainly you hear about those kinds of things a lot, and it's made it very difficult for Puerto Rico to get any momentum in Washington and among its creditors, because you know every time they have put forth a request or a proposal for a debt restructuring, it's been met with you know the response of you know how can we really work with you right now on these issues if we don't know what you're going to do with the money.
Well, the real question is not only what will be done with the money, but the infusion of money. We've had these disasters with FEMA. We've had, you know, things, money just not getting through where it should get through to the people who need it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now that's been a real issue. I know that in some ways, I think the federal government would argue that they've tried to do that, but that people are also a little bit untrusting of them. You know, you've got, for example, the Small Business Administration that's down there ready to loan up to $200,000 per person, up to that amount for home repairs, but people just aren't applying. FEMA is referring a lot of people to the SBA, and the SBA, I think only about one-tenth of the referrals have actually made it to the SBA and sought a loan. So, you know, it's partly communication. Like I said, it's partly the struggle of customizing, you know, traditional methods that work in the, you know, lower 48 to an island that is in many ways a third world country and really not part of the United States except in name.
Yeah, but the government does deserve a lot of culpability here. I mean, I was wondering after Katrina, why so much problems lining up contracts? They should have been lined up ahead of time. They just repeated what they did with Katrina. But let me bring our callers in here and let's find out what's on their minds. And we start with Rebecca. Rebecca, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. My question was, I have several questions, but the one I'm most curious about was the loan issue is, why was Puerto Rico federal aid in a loan format where Texas and Florida were a grant? If anyone could answer that, that would be great.
Well, let's take that question and go to Nick Brown on it, Nick.
It has to do with the territory status. I mean, the Virgin Islands, I believe, also were given a loan, and there have been discussions with the Virgin Islands as well about what was going to happen with that loan and what the payback terms were going to be. So I don't know the real nitty gritty of how that decision came about, but territories are. Kind of operated differently and sometimes have different rules than U.S. states. And
we're getting a lot of people who want to know what the status is of progress towards statehood. Nick, can you clarify that for us?
Well, I don't think there is much progress towards statehood. I know that that's an enormous issue for the current administration, but I don't see there being any momentum towards that in Washington. I think slightly less ambitious goals, like getting a repeal of the Jones Act or getting perhaps an exemption from the Trump tax plan, which, as we've heard, would impose new taxes on Puerto Rican companies. Getting exempted from that or the Jones Act or some other smaller points, but statehood is something that it is the single dividing issue in Puerto Rican politics. The two-party system is made up of a pro-statehood party and a party that does not favor that. And it's been an issue for not time immemorial, but for about 70 years or so. And, I just don't see it really getting off the ground right now.
Rebecca, did you have something else you wanted to raise here?
I was wondering if there could be also a little brief history on the Jones Act and why it is such an issue on getting that resolved and dealt with, because it really seems to negatively impact Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it's very central. Nick Brown, give us a little lesson on the Jones Act, if you could.
Yeah, I don't have a ton of background on the Jones Act. I know that it's a broader act than just having to do with Puerto Rico and ships. But my understanding is it's one of those issues that there's a lot of agreement that it needs to be changed. And you've seen a little bit of progress towards that. You've seen the president waiving it for periods of time before. So there's this agreement in place that, the Jones Act hampers Puerto Rico. Why that doesn't translate into actual action and, actual change, I don't frankly have a good answer for you. I think possibly it's something we just have to blame on political gridlock, as we have to blame a lot of things on political gridlock.
Well, let me bring on more of our callers, and we'll go next to Suleiman. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi there. Good morning. Great show as always. I had a quick question regarding the unique advantages and disadvantages of Puerto Rico becoming a state. Would you mind elaborating about that?
Can you help us here, Nick Brown?
Oh, that's a very broad.
It's pretty general.
Question. Puerto Rico. Right now they don't pay federal taxes, and many people argue that is helpful to them, and that if they were to become a state, it would hamper them financially more than they already are. However, they would also get new benefits. For example, Medicaid and Medicare are not paid in Puerto Rico the same way they are in U.S. states. I would also say, somewhat more philosophically, Puerto Rico might have a little bit more control over its economic vision as a state, because what we've seen in the past is, because they are a territory, their economy is a bit susceptible to the whims of Congress. Congress famously passed tax laws in the second half of the 20th century that were designed to incentivize companies to open up shop in Puerto Rico. Subsequently, Puerto Rico's entire economy became based around serving that manufacturing industry. Now, on paper, that was good for many years, It allowed the island to go from being an agricultural economy to a manufacturing-based one. But as soon as Congress changed its mind in the 90s and early 2000s about whether those taxes were a good thing and repealed them, guess what? The bottom fell out. Puerto Rico didn't have anything else to fall back on, and here we are today, 15 years later, and you know, the biggest crisis in government history. So, in many ways, at least economically, it may actually have more autonomy as a state.
Nick Brown, with us by phone from New York, is Puerto Rico correspondent and former San Juan bureau chief with Reuters. We're going to go to more calls. Let me go first to some questions that are coming in online and through emails. Kurt wants to know, Nick, how many Puerto Ricans were without power before the hurricane?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know. It was I think, a few thousand, but not, 3.4 million, which was the figure that was without power after the hurricane. So I don't know if the question is referring to after Hurricane Irma, but I know there were a handful of people that didn't have power after Irma and were still waiting for it when Maria hit.
Well, Mike wants to know, are the power outages in rural or urban areas? Why aren't there enough utility workers to reboot the grid?
The outages, I think, are affecting more the rural areas than the urban because...
That's definitely the case, yeah.
The infrastructure out there is just not at the same level. Utility worker-wise, I mean, that's... Puerto Rico didn't have enough utility workers, and I don't think any state would have for something this massive, but there is a big question to be discussed about whether there have been enough workers imported since. And it took a while for Puerto Rico to trigger the mutual aid agreements that a lot of states trigger in these disasters in which outside workers come in. The governor faced a lot of criticism for not doing that sooner. What he said was that he deflected blame to the Army Corps of Engineers, basically. He said the Army Corps had assured him that they would be able to handle the job and that they would be able to work with their own contractors and that that didn't happen as quickly as he thought it would. Someone earlier mentioned the Whitefish deal, which was sort of this infamous deal now in which the power utility in Puerto Rico, PREPA, contracted with a company called Whitefish. It was like a $300 million contract, and it was to a firm that was a two-man firm and had never done work on that scale before. And, amid a ton of criticism and congressional investigations, the governor ultimately had to cancel that deal. And so that also was a huge setback in terms of having the manpower on the island.
Since you mentioned the governor, there is a financial oversight board. It's called the Colonial Control Board that's essentially telling the governor to revise a proposed fiscal turnaround plan that he put forward. And there's more in that in labor and other reforms and more room in the budget, supposedly, for energy. This is a deadline that's coming up February 12th, I believe.
Yeah, the governor has to submit an edited version of this fiscal turnaround plan to the oversight board. They would, of course, take issue with being referred to as a colonial control board, but certainly that sentiment...
I said it's being called that, yeah, right.
Yeah, by some, certainly. The governor has... This was the plan you mentioned earlier in which he said that he can't afford to pay even a penny of the debt until fiscal year 2022. And essentially what the oversight board came back and said was give us more detail about the structural reforms, the labor reforms, tax reforms, things that you're going to do to try to create more revenue and more cost savings. But they also said, you can't be afraid to spend money. You have to work into this plan a little bit more capital expenditures. You need to make room for a reserve fund of $1.3 billion over the next 10 years because you might need that money if these storms keep happening and you need to be prepared. So, this back and forth between the governor and the board, this kind of power struggle has been going on for, since the day he took office last January. As you say, there is so much resentment on the island of this board's existence. There are protests, even in New York, outside of most of their meetings. But, it also gives the governor a little bit of political cover to be able to, you know, to try to do things, to try to compromise, for example, with creditors. And then when the oversight board comes back and says, as they have in the past, you can't afford to pay this debt, he can sort of deflect some of that, you know, and say that the oversight board was the bad guy. So, you know, it's I wouldn't call them allies, but it's a very tense relationship between the board and the governor right now.
Getting some comments that are critical of the president. Herb writes, I bet that given the choice, members of the military would prefer the money for Trump's parade be spent on the ground in Puerto Rico rather than in the streets of Washington, D.C. The president has proposed a military parade with hardware and the likes. William writes, shame is not a persuasive strategy in the era of Donald Trump, nor is compassion, responsibility, or logic. And Stephanie wants to know, how much help is being provided by other countries? Can you help us here, Nick Brown?
Yeah, I'm not sure about other countries. I haven't heard anything huge on that, so I would imagine that it's not an enormous piece of the puzzle here. It is interesting on the first two letters to hear about people's thoughts on Trump and how he's been doing. And on the island, you know, as John was saying earlier in your segment, there's a lot of resentment toward him. And there was, by the way, during the campaign. I lived on the island in 2015 and 2016. And, you know, even people that identify as Republicans in Puerto Rico were just shocked that, you know, a candidate like that could get momentum, especially after some of the things he had said about immigration. But what's interesting is now, not necessarily among the masses, but among some of Puerto Rico's leaders, both in the central government and mayors, you're starting to hear some of that rhetoric back off a bit because they know that they need this administration to be their ally. And this president, you know, it's very easy to get on his bad side. And when you're on his bad side, it could be bad for you. I mean, Mayor Cruz knows all about that. She was the target of some pretty nasty tweets from the president a while back. So so if you talk to leaders in Puerto Rico, the governor and some mayors, you know, they'll be very complimentary of the president. I don't know how genuine it is, but the narrative has changed a bit.
I remind you, Nick Brown is with us from New York. He is Puerto Rico correspondent, former San Juan bureau chief with Reuters. And I want to bring Orlando Bravo here. He's a San Francisco-based investor, founder of a Bravo Family Foundation. They raised $25 million for Puerto Rican relief. And Orlando Bravo, good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess a lot of what you've been doing, and I commend you and give kudos to you, has been just to help people in need. I mean, bringing water purifiers, IVs, things that are needed, and also seeing things firsthand. Give us some of your impressions of the needs that are there, particularly the needs with respect to what can be provided.
Yeah, no, look, I appreciate it. It was interesting and sad that nonprofit organizations at the beginning had to take on the role of the government to provide some basic needs. Days after the hurricane, when we came in, we were focused on small towns, particularly around the West Coast. So they're the opposite side of the capital that we were hearing were not getting any aid and basic aid, food and water. And that went on, the basic relief from nonprofits, including ours, went on for about a month. And then it was after that FEMA came. So these mayors and municipalities were bootstrapping themselves, building their own distribution centers, and getting supplies from whoever could deliver it to them on a private basis so that they could literally survive. After about a month, FEMA came in. The system got a little bit less disorganized. And people were no longer in survival mode. Of course, there are exceptions to this, but in general, that was the case. Now, FEMA is going to leave, and there are places that still need those basic necessities. So we're now getting requests back from the municipalities, and our system works as follows. We have people on the ground that work with local mayors, and those local mayors are people that we feel are good operators, trustworthy, and do want and need the help and are receptive to it. They generate the demand, and then we fulfill it with our supply chain, exactly what they need. We're not guessing what is needed. Now we're hearing back that there might be some basic relief that needs to come back into the picture now that FEMA is going to depart.
Well, you've gone in with your own revenue here, and I mean, I know this is your homeland. You're a native of Mayaguez and from Puerto Rico originally, but I think the big lesson, from what I understand, where you're concerned, is that Puerto Rico can't rely on the U.S. government.
Look, that is true, right? And, you know, you look at all these lobbying efforts and these political status questions and these requests for changing the tax code in terms of the latest bill, and none of that works because the voters, percentage-wise, are so small that live in the mainland. And, of course, Puerto Ricans in the island do not have representation. So it's very difficult to move the needle of the mainland U.S. or of the federal government in a way that works for the island. But now at the same time, it is incredibly frustrating that the central government of Puerto Rico has done a very poor job in serving the people. You first need to take care of yourself before you ask for help. And it's very difficult to ask for help when you are bankrupt, when every single... Now, I have a question. Can anybody tell me one single government agency that runs well in Puerto Rico? They all lose money. They're all in debt. They're poorly run. Now, I'm not suggesting that they're not good people that are responsible for these operations, but it's a system that is caving in itself. So you have those two big macro problems and big problems that are going to take a very long time.
Well, I'm looking actually at a comment from a listener who writes, critics point at Puerto Rico's corrupt, ineffective government as the culprit for this mess. Only Puerto Rico isn't a state. It's a territory. It doesn't have the autonomy of a state government. You can't hold Puerto Rico accountable as if it's a state and then also deny its statehood. We're getting a lot of those kind of comments. Let me bring some callers in here and let me get you on next. Dan, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. My question is about something that Puerto Ricans are doing as a result of the problems in Puerto Rico, which is they're moving, and they're moving to the United States because they're a territory. They can move without any immigration hassle, and they can vote. According to, let's see, data from January, 300,000 have moved to Florida. I will remind everyone that Trump won the popular vote there by about 110,000 votes. I would imagine that a good 70% of those people are going to be voting Democratic come 2018. I'd like to hear responses from your guests.
Well, Nick Brown, what do you think? I mean, caller has a point.
No, it's an interesting question. And you know who's also aware that that is happening? Establishment Republicans and establishment Democrats. The parties are moving into those areas. And you know, we've heard that Republicans have done some recruitment trying to just, you know, advertise themselves to Puerto Rican voters. I don't know if it's as black and white as you'd think it would be, that they would vote Democrat. They, you know, Puerto Ricans have in Puerto Rico, the political system is quite different. The party system, I should say, is quite different. So the average Puerto Rican may not, you know, have that deep a grasp on the differences between a Republican and a Democrat. But while they may be, you know, fiscally liberal, culture in Puerto Rico is actually quite socially conservative in some respects. So I am not sold on that being an easy win for Democrats. And I know that that the Republican Party doesn't think so either. But the caller is correct that it's a huge issue and that people are pouring in. And I also wonder, you know, there's 5 million Puerto Ricans in the United States before the storm. And I wonder, and I haven't done any reporting on this, but how how this is going to affect them at the polls, if they're going to maybe be a little more passionate this year.
As long as we're talking about Puerto Ricans coming to the United States, I just want to mention an article in Mother Jones about 3,200 Puerto Ricans who are in jail are being sent to detention facilities in the United States over the next 5 years. This is voluntary, but apparently there are quotas as well, and this has, of course, caused a great deal of controversy. I'm giving some promotion for Mother Jones, so let me also say that you can find a link to an article about how to help hurricane victims at our website, kqed.org/forum, and there's also a link to Nick Brown's special report on Puerto Rico's housing crisis. And I mean, Orlando Bravo, let me get some thoughts from you on, I'm getting some comments here that have to do with race and color, and I'd like, as a native of Puerto Rico, to hear what you have to say. Let me just read them to you. Stephanie says, is there going to be a congressional investigation on this? Seems to be racism. Why isn't this labeled a humanitarian crisis? And Patty says, let's face it, Puerto Rico is just too brown. As a territory, we take their taxes, but don't let them vote. Orlando Bravo.
Well, look, that there is some of that. Not only is it a different race, but just as importantly, it's a very different culture. It's a different language. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if all these factors play into the lack of aid or the lack of visibility, because this is a humanitarian crisis. Now, but I do want to go back to a point, and the voters of Puerto Rico do vote for governor, for mayor, and there are so many good people in Puerto Rico, extremely talented, highly educated, way underemployed. Even if they're employed in a job that is a tenth of their potential. The education levels are high and the motivation is very high. And people are very proud, and they need to demand better responsibility and accountability.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time, but Orlando Bravo, appreciate very much your being with us. And ditto, Nick Brown, thank you for joining us. Thanks also to Mayor Carmen Eulene Cruz and John Sepulvedo. And we have another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to talk about Darwin. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.